Top American officials have been visiting Saudi Arabia and Israel. On the table, normalizing relations.
It would be the biggest diplomatic earthquake in the Middle East in, you know, at least half a century, probably more than that.
But there's still a long way to go. Also today, calculating the environmental costs of war in Ukraine. It'll be many years before reparations would even be considered. But Ukraine's environmental inspectors say collecting data now is crucial for future litigation. And Beijing just is not prepared for heavy rains. So with historic downpours, it is a catastrophe.
Because in Beijing, it normally is the drought that we are concerned of, not the flood.
Plus, a former U.S. president indicted again and European leaders not commenting. Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for coming along today. It's trite, but it is true, especially these days. When it rains, it pours. That's certainly been the case in Beijing lately. China's capital has been pummeled by more than 29 inches of rain since Saturday, the heaviest rainfall Beijing residents have seen in 140 years. At least 20 people have died in the flooding. To find out what it's like to live through that sort of extreme weather, we reached out to Beijing resident Yajun Zhang. Yajun, thanks for being here. Give us a sense of what it's been like living in Beijing over the past few days.
Yeah, Marco, like you said, you know, when it rains, it pours. So as a resident here, luckily we live in the center of the city, so we don't have a landslide in our neighborhood, not like the people who live in mountain areas. So public areas like parks and museums are closed, and a lot of performances and shows are canceled in the capital cities over the last 2 days. And the people were encouraged by the municipal government to work from home. So for me, before the rain starts, I shopped online. So I placed a huge order of groceries to make sure we have enough food in the fridge for the last 2 days. So yeah, a lot of indoor activities, not going out much.
Right. I mean, the images we're seeing in the news and on social media, they're dramatic, they're scary. Cars being swept away, children battling the currents in the streets. What are some of the images that come to mind for you?
So it was really shocking for us seeing one of the you know, horrible images. As you know, Beijing is huge, and the whole capital city is surrounded by mountains. So for the people like me who live in the center of Beijing, the only thing causes us is a little bit inconvenience. But for the residents who live in the mountain area, in the outskirts of Beijing, it has been horrible.
Yeah, really widespread impacts. And it sounds like more than 30,000 people in and around Beijing have been evacuated from their homes. Where are all those people going?
Local government have been mobilizing all of their resources to evacuate the people from home to the safe place, for example, you know, camps or hotels.
Are residents on the whole patient with recovery efforts?
As a resident, you receive messages, constant messages from a municipal government. But a lot of people wasn't aware how bad it can be. Because in Beijing, it normally is the drought that we are concerned of, not the flood. It's not very normal to have big flood like this to affect Beijing. So even when people receive warnings from local government to ask them to evacuate, some people just didn't pay attention, because they didn't feel like, oh, it can be that bad. I think, you know, when people face disaster, there's always, you know, frustration, concern, anxiety for sure. But from what I saw, you know, from the news, the impact of this flood exceeded what people expected.
I mentioned those children in the streets that we saw fighting the floods and the strong currents. Have there been moments of heroism in these past few days?
There were one or two soldiers died because of their efforts rescuing local residents, and there was a report about them. So the government definitely tried to explain how much work the government has been put into the rescue efforts. I think at this moment, particularly on the local level, people have a very strong trust in the government. And I think Beijing is the capital of China. So Beijing is the last place that the Chinese government want to see bad consequences of a natural disaster.
Do people in Beijing, do they link this extreme weather to climate change? What are you hearing?
depends on who you ask. So the people who always pay attention to climate issue, to sustainability issue, you know, that's a direct link. So a lot of my colleagues, friends talking about, oh, we are going to see this kind of extreme weather a lot in the future. It's not only happened to China, but also to the whole world, right? We have extreme heat and extreme weather. But Beijing, like I mentioned, Beijing is a huge place, particularly for the people who live in the suburb. I'm not sure they link the two things together immediately. They may say, you know, it's just a bad year.
And what about Beijing or Chinese officials, not necessarily in the environment space? Are they making the connection when they make public comments?
This flood, I haven't seen a lot talk about this flood. It's a one consequence of climate change. I haven't seen any official coverage to link the two things together, but it could be only me. But for the, let's say, urban elite, for a business leader, academia, you know, the climate topic is a very hot topic these days in China, particularly since the Chinese government, you know, set the goal of a carbon emission peak in 2030 and carbon neutrality in 2060. So I would say it really depends on who you ask.
Beijing resident Yajun Zhang joined us to talk about the torrential rains that have been pummeling the Chinese capital, Beijing. Yajun, thank you very much and stay safe in the coming days.
Thank you very much, Marco.
With each passing day of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, the government in Kyiv is keeping close tabs on the costs of rebuilding. They're also tracking the environmental damage, burned down forests, bombed out national parks, poisoned drinking water, and also coming up with a dollar figure on those incidents. NGOs are stepping in to help with a very specific goal. The World's Carolyn Beeler continues our week-long series looking at the environmental impacts of the war.
Every time a Russian strike hits Ukraine, government environmental inspectors show up at the scene to document the destruction. Last spring, Pavlo Evanov was called to a bombed commercial oil depot outside of Kyiv. He speaks to me through an interpreter.
This concrete floor was completely destroyed. There were huge craters from the rocket impacts. There were scrap metal all over the place.
And tons of oil had leaked out of the depot. Evanov's tests showed toxin levels in the soil 16 times higher than normal. By summer, a 15-acre lake downhill from the depot was about half covered in oil slicks. Walking along the lake, Evanov points to the far edge to show where the oil started.
Basically, from that side, beginning of the lake, up until this wooden gazebo.
It sounds rather dramatic. What was your reaction when you saw that?
I was pretty shocked because in all my career, this is the first time I've seen the disaster of this magnitude.
The results of Evanov's inspection were used to calculate a price tag for the damage caused by this burned and leaking oil. Almost $14 million. As of this week, the government puts the cost of the environmental destruction of the whole war at $56 billion. That figure is meant to track what Russia will owe Ukraine when the war is over. Dmytro Zaruba is deputy head of Ukraine's environmental inspectorate.
This is needed for future litigation in the international courts and future reparations that Russia will pay for all the damage that they have caused.
Zaruba explains the ongoing tally of what Russia owes Ukraine is based on a complex formula. It goes beyond simply calculating an estimate for cleanup costs and lost profits. Imagine something happened to Niagara Falls, he says. How do you estimate what that's worth? A handful of environmental NGOs based both inside and outside Ukraine are compiling their own maps and databases to supplement government efforts. I visited the NGO Eco Action at their office in a tower block in Kyiv to speak with Alex Opanasenko.
I can show you our website.
He's sitting at a conference table pointing to an interactive map on his laptop.
And in the left window you can see a map of Ukraine with different color dots.
Green for damage to industrial facilities, pink for impacts to ecosystems, light blue for nuclear safety risks. When you click on a dot, there's information about the location of the attack, what happened, and when. The dots, Opanasenko says, are meant to mark potentially hazardous sites so they can one day be cleaned up, paid for by Russia, of course.
We try to put attention to this problem because the damage of the environment now it's not a first problem in our country. But we can't forget about it because it's so important.
Eco Action relies on volunteers to comb through news reports, social media posts, and official government websites to find Russian attacks that may cause environmental damage. Sijana Tereshenko spends about a half hour a day in her Kyiv dorm room on this.
Інколи є такий вплив, який ми не бачимо, але він є.
A staffer from EcoAction interprets for her.
When we do not see something, we do not know about the problem. So the importance of my job is to make everything visible.
Tereshenko says most of what she sees is Russian rocket and artillery hits, often on industrial sites where there's a risk of chemical contamination in nearby land or water. A shy 20-year-old, Tereshenko clutches a small stuffed llama on her lap to calm her nerves while we talk. She says spending so much time reading about attacks near where she grew up is hard.
It really impacts me. The first week was the most difficult, but after a while I used to this.
Environmental damages are being better documented in this war than in any previous conflict. That's according to Doug Weir from the UK charity Conflict and Environment Observatory. He says there is some precedent for making aggressors pay out for environmental impacts. For example, after Iraq's invasion of Kuwait.
Money was awarded to states, for example, for the cost of monitoring the health of people from oil well fires, for the cost of cleanup and remediation from oil spills on beaches and on the land. And so the process is there.
The UN has established an official repository for documentation of environmental harm in Ukraine. But Weir cautions it might be too early for Ukraine to be coming up with that dollar figure of its own.
It will be many years until we're in a situation, if we are in a situation, where there will be discussions around how things are valued, what reparations actually look like, and those conversations will rely on the data which is being collected now.
Like data being collected at that bombed-out oil depot outside of Kyiv. Pavlo Evanov, the environmental inspector, says the last time he tested here, toxin levels in the soil were still 3 or 4 times higher than normal.
As far as we know, nothing has been done to remedy the damage.
Cleanup work is largely seen as something that will have to wait until the war is over. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler, Kyiv, Ukraine.
Nearly a third of Ukraine will need to be surveyed and cleared of landmines and other unexploded ordnance. Tomorrow, we'll look at the impact of that on one Ukrainian farmer and hear about how those munitions have been a problem elsewhere in Europe for more than a century. Congratulations are in order for Simon Squibb. He's the new owner of a staircase in southwest London, a stairway to not heaven. It's a stairway to nowhere. The four-story glass-enclosed stairwell is no longer connected to the building it once served. Squibb bought it at an auction for £29,000, nearly $37,000. The 49-year-old runs an online community that helps entrepreneurs get started. He told the BBC he wants to turn the staircase into something that represents that anything is possible. What that could be remains something of a mystery. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. For decades, Israel and Saudi Arabia have not had official diplomatic relations. In more recent years, that started to shift. Behind closed doors, there have been signs of warming ties. That partly comes from shared concerns about regional security threats, namely Iran's influence in the Middle East. Now the Biden administration is reinvigorating efforts to bring Israel and Saudi Arabia officially together. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
In the past few weeks, top American officials have been visiting Saudi Arabia and Israel to investigate whether a normalization deal might be possible. An agreement would be a huge step towards ending the Arab-Israeli conflict, says Hussein Ibish with the think tank Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington.
It would be the biggest diplomatic earthquake in the Middle East in, at least half a century, probably more than that.
But brokering a deal would be a heavy lift. Saudi Arabia has put forward a series of substantial demands. They want a NATO-level security deal with the U.S. that would guarantee assistance if they are attacked.
The United States has not signed a written security agreement with a single, you know, bilateral agreement with a non-democratic authoritarian state since the agreement with South Korea in the 1950s. All right, so they're very unusual.
The Saudis also want a civilian nuclear program and American-made anti-ballistic missile defense system. Experts say these things are negotiable, but what could actually break the deal is the kingdom's insistence on a resolution to the Palestinian issue. Ibish says it doesn't seem like the Israelis would be willing to budge.
The current Israeli government is adamant that they will not make any concessions to the Palestinians, and they're on a slow train toward, well, it's not even that slow, a medium speed train to annexation and more settlement.
The Saudis also have to navigate domestic opposition, says Aziz Al-Qashian in Riyadh. He's an expert on Saudi-Israeli policy and has researched public sentiment in the kingdom towards normalization with Israel. He says surveys show there is little interest.
For a long time, this has been perceived as this is an occupier. This is a state that's not good.
The Saudi ruling elite know this, Akashian explains, and they don't want to risk alienating the public unless there is substantial benefit to a deal. He also points out that it's important not to leave the Palestinians out of these conversations. Meanwhile, President Biden doesn't have a lot of time, and his administration has been talking about a deal for a while. Here's Jake Sullivan, National Security Advisor, at a discussion at the Washington Institute in May.
Ultimately, getting to full normalization is a declared national security interest of the United States. We have been clear about that.
Danny Ayalon, former Israeli ambassador to the U.S., told Israelis I-24 News that Biden needs a major foreign policy victory before the lead-up to the election campaign.
Here, I think both countries, the United States and Saudi Arabia, are playing with cards that they don't really have.
Ayalon cast doubts on a deal before the campaign start. But other Arab Gulf countries have normalized ties with Israel. The United Arab Emirates signed an agreement with the Israelis in 2020. So did Bahrain. And if Biden gets the Saudis to have open diplomatic relations with Israel, it would be a significant breakthrough with far-reaching implications for the Middle East. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
You've heard the headlines. Former President Donald Trump has been indicted again. Special Counsel Jack Smith delivered the details.
Good evening. Today, an indictment was unsealed, charging Donald J. Trump with conspiring to defraud the United States, conspiring to disenfranchise voters, and conspiring and attempting to obstruct an official proceeding.
The official proceeding being the 2020 presidential election. It's water cooler talk everywhere, except apparently among foreign leaders who so far are keeping their opinions to themselves. To learn more about how European leaders seem to be calculating the moment, we call Jeremy Shapiro. He's a research director at the European Council on Foreign Relations, where he focuses on the transatlantic relationship. Jeremy, what foreign leaders are weighing in at this point?
I haven't heard anything from any European leaders. I think they're thinking that discretion is the better part of valor when it comes to a Trump indictment.
Yeah, why is that, do you think?
Because they're very aware of the possibility that Donald Trump might be the next president of the United States, despite all of these indictments. And in the 2016 campaign, several European leaders made the mistake of commenting negatively on him, going against the European tradition of not commenting on U.S. domestic politics. And they regretted it when he became president, so they don't want to make that mistake again.
I mean, what you just said is interesting because the allegations and the indictments do not really seem in line, to say the least, with the EU's democratic values. So why aren't they commenting on it?
They certainly aren't in line with Europe's democratic values. And I can tell you from my individual discussions that it is very hard to find a European official outside of really Hungary or maybe Poland that wants Donald Trump to be the next president. But, you know, the United States is a very powerful country. It is very important to every European country. It is very important to them to have a good bilateral relationship with the United States, no matter who the president is. And they are aware that they may have to deal with Donald Trump, whether they like it or not. And that implies, given how touchy he is, that they should probably be holding their criticism of his lack of commitment to democracy until after the election.
I guess one way to approach this is, what are foreign governments not saying? Like, assess for us how foreign governments are worried about the stability of American democracy right now.
By and large, the European governments are extremely nervous about this. They really do believe that Donald Trump represents somewhat of an existential threat to the transatlantic alliance and possibly to American democracy. And it's their view that if American democracy falters, that it will falter all over the world, including in Europe. So they view it extremely seriously. I think the issue is they have no idea what to do about it.
So if you're Volodymyr Zelensky, someone who has been on the phone with Trump, who Trump has painted right into his scandals, and Trump is still saying he's got good relations with Putin, what are you thinking right now if you're Zelensky?
Various Ukrainians are quite worried about a Trump administration. They're worried when Donald Trump says that he could solve the Ukraine war in 24 hours through a couple of phone calls to Vladimir Putin, that that means that Trump would sell out Ukrainian interests to the Russians.
So it's pretty clear why a lot of European leaders are not talking about this Trump indictment. What is the downside of being quiet, do you think, Jeremy?
I don't think that there is a downside of being quiet. I guess you don't get to express yourself, which is often fun, but I don't think that there is any upside for Europeans. It's not as if it really can change the outcome in any way. The courts, the American public opinion is not really super interested in what European leaders think about this. In any case, the European leaders are, I think, probably making the best choice, but it is a frustrating one.
Jeremy Shapiro is a research director at the European Council on Foreign Relations, where he's focused on the transatlantic relationship. Good to have you with us today, Jeremy. Thank you very much.
Sure. Thank you.
More news and stories from around the globe still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World. Warming waters in the Mediterranean mean there's a new invasive species swimming around, the lionfish. They're big and they're pretty, but with a ferocious appetite that's causing damage to the sea's ecosystem.
They're eating everything on the reef.
Taming the lionfish in Turkey, plus its adios to a Women's World Cup heavyweight, still coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Cases of Hansen's disease, better known as leprosy, have jumped sharply in Florida, and it's not the only tropical disease that's becoming more common in the southern United States. Professor Peter Hotez is dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. We called him up to help us understand what's driving the rise of illnesses in the U.S. that are more commonly found in the tropics. So let's start with the news out of Florida, Professor. How does leprosy spread? And what is the prevailing theory about why there's an increase of cases in Florida?
Well, many people are surprised to learn that we have leprosy in the United States. We actually had a leprosy hospital in Louisiana for many decades in Carville, Louisiana, and it has some significant prevalence here in the South. In the case of leprosy, part of it may be due to the fact that the mycobacterium that causes leprosy is found in armadillos, and armadillos are found in the southern United States. But in many cases, we can't identify any contact with armadillos as having a role of transmission of leprosy. But the bottom line is the southern United States is a disease endemic country for a variety of tropical infections.
Well, other tropical diseases have been on the rise. I'm thinking mosquito-borne illnesses like malaria, found this past June. In 2016, there was the Zika outbreak. What's going on?
Well, first of all, we tend not to look for these diseases because they often occur a bit off the beaten path, especially in low-income communities. One of the things that we've always observed is whenever we look, we find these diseases, these tropical infections. But if you don't look, you don't find them. You have to, you know, have your antenna up and be prepared to make a diagnosis in someone who has a fever, let's say, or has a rash, or has unusual signs and symptoms. And unfortunately, a lot of the docs, physicians, and healthcare providers are not trained to recognize and diagnose tropical diseases, and the diagnostic testing is not always very easily accessible. So a lot of these diseases get missed. But I think what's happening is I think climate change is having a role, warming temperatures, higher temperatures. I mean, we're baking right now. Where I'm talking to you from is in Texas, and it's been 100 degrees every day.
What connection do you see between poverty and the spread of tropical diseases in places that didn't previously have them?
I think poverty is often that hidden driver because of open sewage in low-income communities, inadequate sanitation, poor quality housing, often without window screens that invite insect vectors such as mosquitoes, the tire dumping that occurs in poor neighborhoods that facilitate the development of mosquitoes such as Aedes aegypti mosquitoes that transmit so many tropical viruses. So poverty is a huge driver, every bit as important as climate change and urbanization.
Americans do have a history of helping tropical countries combat disease. There's the Carter Center's work on Guinea worm, the Gates Foundation on malaria, not to mention the efforts of USAID, the government agency. Is there similar support inside the U.S. for tropical disease prevention?
Unfortunately, not really. I think part of it is because poverty is a major risk factor for those diseases on the African continent and elsewhere in low and middle income countries, but it's also a risk factor here. And trying to convince political leaders that there's a depth and breadth of poverty that people don't appreciate, I think, is really critical. For instance, we had in 2017 the UN's United Nations Special Rapporteur on Poverty visit the United States, including the southern United States, in part because we, and together with an environmental justice activist, Catherine Coleman Flowers, had, one of our faculty, Rahelia Mejia, had found hookworm infection in rural Alabama. And the UN Special Rapporteur pointed out we have 18 million Americans who live in extreme poverty at half the U.S. poverty level, and 5 million Americans living on less than $2 a day, which is the global poverty standard. But that's a tough message that often elected leaders don't want to hear.
How concerned are you that we're going to see more such outbreaks, Peter?
Well, you know, I made a big career change 12 years ago by leaving the Northeast and coming to Texas and the Gulf Coast because I recognized that this was going to be significant, that tropical infections are on the rise, and we need centers such as like our School of Tropical Medicine to build new diagnostics, build new vaccines, and we've been busy ever since.
Professor Peter Hotez, helping us understand the rise in tropical diseases here in the U.S. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Warming waters in the Mediterranean Sea have attracted a new resident, the lionfish. With bright red stripes and large venomous spines, lionfish are an invasive species in many parts of the globe, and climate change is dramatically expanding the predator's territory. That's the focus today of our climate solution segment, The Big Fix.
Change is coming.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
What we do now will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
Along the coast of southern Turkey, scuba divers and restaurants are banding together to combat the lionfish invasion. Their solution? Serve them up on a plate. The world's Duri Biskaran reports from the town of Akyaka.
You start with a good olive oil from a village nearby. Not too much. Enis Özsoy prepares a plate of lionfish in her beachside restaurant, Agape Jova. She combines tangy capers and fragrant garlic. A light salad of shredded zucchini and carrot sits to one side of the plate.
Yeni balık eski tat.
It's a new fish, but an old taste, Özsoy says. She's using a local recipe that's been adapted for lionfish, that colorful creature that's wreaking havoc on Mediterranean ecosystems. It happens to taste great fried, with a light drizzle of pomegranate molasses.
Çok küçük bir şey ve hatta biz istersek...
Özsoy calls it a tiny solution to the climate crisis, a way to adapt that keeps people fed. Eating invasive lionfish is already popular in other parts of the world, like the Caribbean and the Florida Keys, but there are only a couple dozen restaurants that serve lionfish in Turkey. Özsoy says she's proud to be one of them. Akyaka is a former fishing village turned beachside resort. It's nestled in a bay on Turkey's turquoise coast. But lionfish are native to the South Pacific and the Indian Oceans, more than 3,000 miles away.
They're eating everything on the reef.
Back in 2015, divers like Zafer Kızılkaya of the Mediterranean Conservation Society started to notice lionfish in Turkish waters. They probably came up through the Suez Canal from the warmer waters of the Red Sea.
He was tiny. It's a bit, oh, how cute it is. But just in 2-3 months, you know, it just spread all over the Mediterranean coast.
Lionfish can grow to be a foot or even longer. They are ferocious hunters, able to consume 90% of their body weight every day. And they eat almost everything, from fish that keep algae levels in check to crunchier creatures like crabs and shrimp. The Mediterranean Sea is warming about 3 times faster than the global average. Local wildlife is suffering, Kızılkaya says, while invasive species like the lionfish are thriving.
According to our analysis, every year, invasive species biomass increases 2.05%.
In other words, the growth of invasive fish is outstripping native species in the Mediterranean.
In 2025, more than 30% of the whole fish biomass will be invasive.
Kızılkaya recently won a Goldman Environmental Prize for his work to protect marine ecosystems. He says fishermen in southern Turkey were finding lionfish and other invasive species in their nets and throwing them out. So his organization got a $16,000 grant and started to buy the extra fish.
Since we want to set it up this system, any fisher who had 2 kilograms of lionfish, we send the car,
pick up the fish, and sell it to local restaurants. Once chefs got a taste, they told him it's exactly what they had been looking for, venomous spines and all.
The fish looks so splendid, and they love the fish. They said that we could do this fish whatever we like. It is cheap, texture is great, it's not a fishy smell.
Chefs started experimenting. They grilled it or battered and fried it. Some added citrus and herbs for a nice ceviche. Others seared it with a marinade. More money came in and Kızılkaya expanded, finding better ways to freeze the fish so they were easier to transport and sell. So far this year, his group has sold 3,000 pounds of lionfish. The United Nations Development Program also provided funding. Mehmet Golge manages the Marine Invasive Species Project for UNDP Turkey.
There is no predator for the lionfish. Humankind will be the predators of the lionfish.
Mature lionfish can lay 2 million eggs a year. But to really catch a lot of them, Golge says, you have to hunt them with a spear.
It's not very easy to catch them by nets.
The Turkish government doesn't give out many permits to do spear fishing, fearing that unethical divers will go after dolphins, seals, or other native animals. But it's a popular practice in other parts of the world, including the Florida Keys.
And you've got to trust your dive community enough to at least consider it. And there's no other way to catch them. They don't bite a hook.
Dr. Steve Giddings is science coordinator for the National Marine Sanctuary Program at NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. He says lionfish descended on the Caribbean in 2010. Spear hunting wasn't enough, so he's working on building better traps.
A lot of lionfish just hung out outside the traps. Because, you know, they could see fish swim by and pounce on them. I had an idea at the time to develop a trap that would be a non-containment type trap that would just attract lionfish. And then when the trap was pulled, a large net laying on the bottom would come up around all the fish and pull them all up.
More lionfish on your plate means fewer in the ocean. And Giddings says his favorite way to eat them is chunked and blackened over a nice Caesar salad. Startups are figuring out other ways to use lionfish, like producing leather or even jewelry.
You know, they're beautiful fish that somebody once called them a cross between a butterfly and a porcupine. But it has to be more than just eating. If you want to create a long-term viable solution, you've got to add even more value to the individual fish.
All we can hope for, Giddings says, is to keep lionfish numbers down to a manageable level. But once lionfish come, they're here to stay. For the world, I'm Derry Buscarin, Akiaka, Southern Turkey.
Tensions between Armenia and Azerbaijan are leading to a humanitarian crisis. In recent months, Azerbaijan has imposed a blockade on Nagorno-Karabakh. That's the territory that the two nations have fought over for decades. The World's Daniel Offman reports on how, just in the past few days, the conflict has come to a head.
For Armenians living in the mountainous region of Nagorno-Karabakh, the Lachin Corridor is the one road connecting them to Armenia. And that's where Azerbaijan has set up a military checkpoint. Last week, thousands of people in Yerevan, Armenia's capital, came out to protest Azerbaijan's blockade. They chanted Artsakh, the Armenian name for Nagorno-Karabakh. The next day, Armenia tried sending humanitarian aid to the region. A convoy of dozens of trucks filled with food and other goods were stopped by Azerbaijan at the Lachin Corridor checkpoint, and they've been held up there for a week, still waiting to enter. Meanwhile, in Stepanakert, the largest city in Nagorno-Karabakh, ethnic Armenians are suffering.
The life for the past months, it is disastrous. The situation is close to starvation.
This is Nina Shahverdian. She's a school teacher in her early 20s.
We don't have any medicine. We don't have any fuel. We barely have electricity. When we don't have electricity, we don't have internet as well. We don't have any food supplies coming in. People right now are struggling with what to put on the table.
Shahverdian says that a big portion of her day is spent trying to get food.
There are huge lines in the city, like to buy just one or two loaves of bread. And my brother yesterday, he stood for 1.5 hours. And it's only just to get the bare minimum bread.
Shahverdian says that people who have gardens have begun growing fruits and vegetables themselves to supplement their diets. I asked Shahverdian about her health and whether she feels that she and her family are getting enough food.
During past 1.5 months, I've lost more than 3 kilos. My brother lost more than 4 kilos. So I think that answers the question.
If measures are not taken in the coming weeks or months, an actual famine could start.
That's Tigran Grigoryan. He's the head of the Regional Center for Democracy and Security based in Yerevan. He says that Russia and Azerbaijan share responsibility here. In 2020, Russia brokered a ceasefire agreement between Armenia and Azerbaijan, where Russian peacekeepers were supposed to manage the Lachin Corridor. In the years since, Azerbaijan has taken control.
This is a direct consequence of the war in Ukraine, because of which the influence of Russia has significantly decreased in the region, and also the interests of Russia have been shifting. That's why Azerbaijan has been testing Russia's red lines on the ground.
Azerbaijan considers Nagorno-Karabakh to be part of its sovereign territory, and Azerbaijan has tried to justify its Lachin Corridor checkpoint as a security measure. Meanwhile, as this crisis continues to unfold, Armenia and Azerbaijan are still holding peace talks.
In my understanding, you cannot just ignore the elephant in the room, the blockade, the humanitarian crisis in Nagorno-Karabakh, and move forward with these so-called peace talks.
Zaur Shiriev, a Baku-based analyst with the crisis group, says that until now, the United States has played a key role in keeping the peace talks alive.
The expectation now is that that agreement should be signed by end of the year, the key date in the process. And many worry that if it doesn't happen by then, the U.S. will enter its pre-election period, potentially decreasing its focus and intervention.
Shadiev says many issues remain unresolved, like the status of ethnic Armenians in Nagorno-Karabakh, future security arrangements, and the freedom of movement through the Lachin Corridor. But despite that, Shadiev believes that ongoing dialogue between the two sides can be productive even if a deal doesn't resolve all these questions.
Even if sides succeed in signing an agreement, what will happen the day after peace agreement is reached?
Back in Stepanakert in Nagorno-Karabakh, Nina Shahverdian, the schoolteacher, doesn't trust that Azerbaijan would uphold a future peace agreement with Armenia.
This is not just our local issue in here. This is an international issue. This is a humanitarian crisis. And I'm thinking that the way the West pressures Russia to stop the war in Ukraine, the same tactics can be applied to Azerbaijan to stop this. The bare fact that the blockade continues is a proof that they don't do enough.
Over the weekend, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke with Azerbaijan's president. Blinken said that he expressed deep concern for the deteriorating humanitarian situation in Nagorno-Karabakh and urged all sides to continue dialogue. Armenians living in Nagorno-Karabakh, though, are looking for more than just words and are hoping that the blockade is lifted as soon as possible. For the world, I'm Daniel Offman.
As you may have heard, this summer we're running a series we're calling Planet Hip Hop. Today, we go to South Korea. Some of you will instantly recognize K-pop supergroup BTS there. These boy and girl bands almost always have a rapper or two in their lineup. Hip-hop found its footing in South Korea in the 1990s. Haegyung has written extensively about Korean pop culture. She also teaches global popular music and Asian music industries at the University of Liverpool. So put us in South Korea in 1992. What was going on? What was the scene like when hip-hop kind of landed in Seoul?
Well, 1990 was a very, very dynamic period. Korea became the 10th largest economy by early 1990s. And then also in 1990s, there was always a birth of a culture, popular culture, of a new generation, a youth culture. And these teenagers really embraced the consumerism and the Western popular culture. But at the same time, they also wanted to rebel against the established social and cultural rules. So in this context, hip-hop gained a huge popularity among Korean youth.
So hip-hop kind of grew up as South Korea rebuilt and gained that global economic muscle. There's a rapper named Epic High, a track called Lesson 2, which we can listen to. Tell me about Epic High.
Epic High, their rap seems to be very fine and very, listed poetically, very pleasing if you are a Korean speaker. So it's a quite good way to learn about Korean hip hop in many ways, in terms of rhyme and flow and in terms of the lyrical content.
So this is lesson two from Epic High. What is the lesson here, Haegyung?
Lesson is, what is the failing political system and the corruption of the politicians and business and everything? So they're really, really critical about everything that the capitalism and the democracy can offer, because usually those are the things which are meant to be all the good things have been abused by those who are in power. It's a lie.
With the explosion of K-pop in Western countries, it's really put the Korean music industry under a microscope, and Korea's music business has been active in promoting itself around the globe. Some of the reaction often is about Korean rappers and idols getting charged with appropriating other cultures' aesthetics and sounds. What is the perspective of Korean artists?
Oh, this is quite a very, very difficult question. I think there are two sides to it. One is the ongoing problem with the Korean industry. And to some extent, also there's a complacency from the artists themselves, not all of them, but because there's some tendency of a color blindedness, because they really don't see, Western popular music that they see as American pop, rather than black music or non-black music and so on and so forth. And that will exacerbate what is already sometimes can be quite delicate. And Korea used to pride itself as a homogeneous ethnic group or race. So the ideas of multi-ethnicity or multiculturalism are relatively kind of a new idea, new in Korea. In this context, they find the multiculturalism and the differences have become a kind of something which they don't really have a very sensitive to, but that this doesn't justify it.
Yeah, so just to conclude, I guess, with some music, what does an authentic Korean hip-hop song sound like? And do you have an example?
I was kind of thinking about Tiger JK and the RM, the collaboration. This piece is called Timeless. So it's a quite intricate kind of a rap. And Tiger K, who was a kind of first generation who really kind of did quite a lot to really establish hip-hop as we know. And then RM, who is a kind of a known to be idol rapper. It brings a different generation. So this really makes the music really an interesting kind of a bond to bring people together. And then hip-hop is the kind of link between these two. Now,
Hey, it's Young Om with the University of Liverpool joining us for our series Planet Hip Hop. We've got a playlist including music from South Korea and other places around the globe where hip hop has made an impact. You can find the music wherever you follow us on social media. High drama at the Women's World Cup today. Team Brazil came to Australia with the hopes of hoisting the trophy for their global superstar Marta's sixth and final World Cup. Brazil needed a win against Jamaica to advance to the round of 16. Jamaica needed a tie. The Brazilians kept shooting and shooting.
As they come forwards once again. And here they come. And it's Davina into Marta. Trying to get a shot away.
18 shots for Brazil.
Strike from distance, and the ball just ran under her feet.
Just three shots for Jamaica.
Caroline and Altamirez takes a time.
Nothing was going in. With 10 minutes to go, the Brazilians brought in some fresh legs.
Is this to be the curtain call on a wonderful World Cup career? At the age of 37, she's prepared to fight for her side, and fight is exactly what she's been doing. Now it's up to the substitutes.
But the Brazilian women still could not find the back of the net. Final score 0-0.
Says that's it. They have done it. Can you believe this?
Jamaica moves on.
The biggest night in Jamaican history.
The first women's team from the Caribbean to advance to the knockout round. And for Brazil, eighth ranked in the world, a return ticket home to start climbing the hill again for 2027. Leaving you today with a taste of Brazil's Jorge Ben. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. You be safe, stay strong. We'll see you again tomorrow. Foi uma linda história de amor, oh, 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 que até hoje eu já ouvi contar. Do amor do príncipe Chagéran pela princesa Nilmahal. Do amor do príncipe Chagéran pela princesa.